Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
Ukrainian and Russian negotiators are preparing to meet in Turkey today for face-to-face talks on ending the war. It's the latest round of direct negotiations after a pause of more than 2 weeks. But so far, there has been little hope of a breakthrough. We'll get analysis in just a moment from Dr. Taras Kuzio, who's Professor of Political Science at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy and security expert on Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia. But first, I'm joined on the line by Jake Cordell, journalist with the Moscow Times. Good morning, Jake, and thank you for joining us. I want to start with that news that we heard last evening. These reports that Roman Abramovich, the Russian oligarch who has been owner of Chelsea Football Club for nearly 20 years, that he was caught up in a suspected poisoning attack along with other Ukrainian negotiators during peace talks. Now, it seems this morning that there are a lot more questions than answers around this. What do we know about what might have happened?
Yeah, a very dramatic story that broke last night on the eve of the first face-to-face negotiations between the two sides in 2 weeks. So we know that this story, Roman Abramovich, his spokesperson, has confirmed that he suffered poisoning-like symptoms, which he describes as sore eyes and peeling skin. And other people who have been poisoned say that these are symptoms that they suffered as well. We know that this is alleged to have occurred on the 3rd of March, so more than 3 weeks ago now, at the negotiations between the Russian and Ukrainians at the Belarusian border. And there are two other Ukrainian officials who were also alleged to have been poisoned. Now, this story was first broken by the Wall Street Journal, and they say that this was an attempt by Russian hardliners to push back and thwart the negotiation attempt just 10 days into the war at this stage. And some other investigative outlets have also said that they also have evidence that this poisoning attack occurred. However, the US has said they don't believe it's occurred. And it also throws a light onto what Roman Abramovich's role in these negotiations are. Why is this story just coming out now after for so long he tried to downplay his role in the negotiations and pretend he wasn't very close to the Kremlin? Now he's put himself at the centre of the negotiations and saying that he suffered a poisoning attack.
And the information about this, it's coming from Roman Abramovich's camp and it hasn't been independently confirmed or verified.
That's right. The stories that have public sources all say that the Roman Abramovich's spokesperson confirmed that, or a source close to Roman Abramovich has confirmed this. And again, we have to question, why is this coming out now? You know, Roman Abramovich tried for so long to distance himself from the Kremlin because he was fearful of being sanctioned as an oligarch close to Vladimir Putin. And he downplayed his role in the negotiations. However, the Ukrainian side have been quite public that Abramovich was playing quite a key role in the negotiations, even acting as a personal go-between between Zelensky and Putin. So again, there are questions over the timing of this, just on the eve of negotiations, and over where this information is coming from and why Roman Abramovich's team would want to confirm this now.
So on those talks, on those negotiations, there's a report in the Financial Times that Russia could be dropping that demand for the denazification of Ukraine. How significant would that be, Jake?
That would be a quite huge shift in Russian negotiating position. Remember, denazification, or the fact that Russia believes Ukraine had become Nazified, was one of the key reasons put forward for going into Ukraine in the first place. And this idea of denazification has always been seen as code for regime change, for removing Volodymyr Zelensky. Vladimir Putin said publicly he wanted Volodymyr Zelensky out of office. So the fact that the Russia may be looking at dropping that basically means they may be happy with Volodymyr Zelensky staying in office. Now, that may be a hard sell back home to the Russian public when they're talked about Nazis and drug dealers in Kiev to then say, OK, we accept them carrying on. But it may be a belated recognition from the Russian camp that the military campaign isn't going as well as they expected. They haven't achieved their aim, despite what they said, that the first phase has been successful and they're refocusing on the Donbass. If the negotiators really are happy to keep Zelensky in office, it could be a clear sign that they are happy to focus on the Donbass and do not want this grand ambition of regime change. However, there are questions how much aligned is Vladimir Putin back in Moscow with his negotiating team on the ground in Turkey, and is he willing to accept any compromise at the moment?
So when you speak to your contacts then in Moscow, what do they say about how optimistic they are for these talks?
I don't think there's any real optimism that today is going to be the breakthrough. These are the first face-to-face talks in 2 weeks. It may just be a reconnection, a resetting out of agendas. The Ukrainian side say that every single point has major discrepancies. It's not like they've got some of it agreed and they're moving on to the next point. There's no one point that's been substantially agreed. And we are seeing a disconnect between who the decision makers are. There still isn't high-level contacts going on in these negotiations. So there is a question as to Marcus, how how much these people on the ground around the table from Moscow side are actually authorized to concede any compromises, or whether they're just setting out their position, getting some feedback, and then taking it back to Moscow.
Jake, thank you very much indeed. That's Jake Cordell there from the Moscow Times. And as I said, for analysis now, we're joined by Dr. Taras Kuzio, Professor of Political Science at the National University of Kiev, Mohyla Academy and Security Expert on Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia. And thank you for joining us, Dr. Kuzio. First to those poisoning story that we're hearing about Roman Abramovich. Do you think that's true and right? What are you hearing about it?
Well, I think that it is probably right, and it's probably a reflection of the fact of when it happened, which was in the early part of the invasion. Russia was still then optimistic that it was going to succeed in basically occupying Ukraine, the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, running away, and then eventually capturing the capital city. Since then, or we're talking 3 or 4 weeks ago, since then, of course, the picture has completely changed, and Russia's not likely to be successful in its original goals. So I think that was probably more a reflection of the time it happened. Mm-hmm.
What's the logic, though, Taras? You know, would Putin risk a poisoning attack that would affect his own side as well, if we're to believe that Roman Abramovich is on his side?
Well, you know, I mean, we have to understand how Putin works. I mean, Vladimir Putin, I mean, it's about time, and I think finally Western governments are coming around to understand this. Vladimir Putin's a sociopath. He doesn't care an iota about human life, whether it's Russian or non-Russian. I mean, that should now finally have dawned on people, firstly. Secondly, these oligarchs are dispensable. I mean, they're not, you know, they're allies today, and they can be gotten rid of tomorrow. A few weeks ago, Putin did a really one of his horrible speeches where he declared these people living abroad with all these riches to be basically traitors. So I don't, you know, Abramovich made his money with Putin allowing that to happen. Then in return, Abramovich had to give him political support. But maybe Abramovich's days are numbered. And, you know, this isn't the first time that they've done something as brazen as this. I mean, after all, 4 years ago on British soil, a chemical attack took place in the city of Salisbury. Mm-hmm. And then prior to that, in 2006, Russian exile Litvinenko was murdered in London. So I don't think we should be surprised.
Can I talk to you about this report in the Financial Times? We had a chat with Jake about it, that Russia may no longer demand that Ukraine be denazified. Now, how much significance do you attach to that?
Well, I think it is significant if it's true, and we all have to be very cautious in accepting what comes out of Moscow. They are serial liars. I mean, I'm sorry to be so brazen about this, but they are. I mean, they have a track record of lying about everything, including MH17, the airliner that was shot down in 2014, and saying that they would never invade Ukraine. I mean, they don't tell the truth. So, yes, if it's true, it would be a major change in Russian strategy, because denazification is not what it seems to a Western audience. Denazification is basically destroying Ukrainian national identity and culture, in the same way as, shall we say, the comparison would be to Ireland, where British rule tried to destroy Irish language and culture, and in return replace it with some kind of either pro-Russian or, in the case of Ireland, pro-British alternative. And in the Ukrainian case, denazification meant transforming Ukraine into a second Belarus, little Russians, not Ukrainians. That's obviously not going to happen, even if they backtrack on their demand, because nowhere have Russian invading forces been welcomed. So how do you achieve your goal anyway? So I think if it's true, great. It means that there are some people in Moscow realizing that these initial goals were not realistic. But let's not get the champagne out so early.
Do you think that there is room for compromise, that something may give in this round of talks?
I think the big sticking points are going to be and I just don't see how you get round them. Russian demand for Ukraine to recognize Russian sovereignty over places like Crimea and the Donbas. These are areas that were already controlled by Russia prior to the 24th of February invasion. It's going to be difficult for the president of a country who is in the constitution supposed to be defending the territorial integrity of the state to accept that, and popular opinion is opposed to that as well. So I don't see how you get around that. And then the second sticking point is going to be, can you really imagine this macho Vladimir Putin withdrawing his forces from the areas, particularly in the south, that have been occupied, like the city of Mariupol? I mean, if he's withdrawing his forces, what was the point of destroying the city of Mariupol then? I find that those areas are going to be major, major sticking points. I mean, people like Putin, if he agrees to withdraw, it's basically the end of his political career. He cannot survive in that dictatorship. Mm-hmm. He cannot be seen to have been defeated. So I think those are going to be major sticking points. Maybe he will have no choice in the end because of battlefield losses on the ground and because of the impact of economic financial sanctions. But we'll see.
And looking at it now, I mean, what do you think a Russian victory might look like?
Well, a Russian victory would be, which I don't think is going to happen now, because the most important goal that Putin had was to capture the capital city. I mean, you can't occupy and control a country if you don't control the capital city, and remove Zelensky. Zelensky, for Putin, became a personal in all sorts of ways. And if that's not going to happen, I'm not sure how a Russian victory could manifest itself. I mean, potentially by Russia continuing to control what it's occupied since the invasion began on the 24th of February. Maybe that would be seen in Moscow as some kind of victory. I mean, what's happened is that Ukrainian forces have fought the Russian forces to a standstill, and now Ukrainian forces in some areas, particularly around Kiev and to the northeast in Kharkiv, are doing counteroffensives and taking back territory. But we're still a while from Ukrainian forces being victorious. So it's sort of, and the unknown factor here is that Russia fights in a different way to how we fight in the West. The Russian leadership doesn't give an iota, doesn't care at all about human losses, about the losses that their troops are suffering. And that is the problem. They just keep throwing in these conscripts who are getting killed. And so the war will continue until they presumably run out of these conscripts.
What do you think when you hear President Zelensky indicating perhaps that there might be a concession available on Donbass, saying that perhaps the application to join NATO may be dropped? We know that it will need a constitutional amendment and a referendum if that were to happen. But what do you think of that strategy?
Well, there's no real. I mean, I wouldn't be necessarily in favor of it, but I don't see that as a big sticking point, the dropping of NATO, because that wasn't on the cards anyway. NATO wasn't about to offer Ukraine membership, but it has to come with two other things. Firstly, the European Union should offer Ukraine EU membership perspective. So in that sense, Ukraine would become like Ireland, Austria, and Sweden, a neutral country in the EU and not in NATO. If that doesn't happen, then Ukraine remains in this gray zone between these two blocks, Eurasian Economic Union and the EU, and it's always going to be there for an area of contestation. So Europe needs to, as it were, declare that Ukraine is part of its future, as it were. And the second problem is the whole question of security guarantees. Ukraine has been, shall we say, stiffed once before. It gave up the world's third largest nuclear weapons in 1994 to 96. And in return, it received these useless and worthless security assurances in the so-called Budapest Memorandum that obviously had no effect on Russia in 2014 and in 2022. So Zelensky is calling for something more concrete, signed by the Western powers, maybe something similar to what the US has signed in terms of security guarantees with Taiwan, with South Korea, for example, because that's what's what Ukraine would demand in return for giving up potential membership of NATO.
We've spoken here on this program to a Ukrainian MP, Sviatoslav Yurash, several times during the war. He's also chair of the Irish-Ukrainian Friendship Group in the Ukrainian Parliament. That's no coincidence that that exists. And you've written about connections and parallels between Ireland and Ukraine.
Yes. The similarities are uncanny. In both in terms of Northern Ireland and the Donbass, in both regions, you have these what I would call empire loyalists. In the Donbass, they are sort of nostalgic for the former Soviet Union, for Russia. In Northern Ireland, they're nostalgic for the old, you know, the Britain that no longer exists, the Britain that existed until the 1950s, shall we say. So that's one comparison. The second comparison is that both countries suffered terrible famines at the hands of the British Empire and the Soviet state. And these famines weren't just a case of people dying from hunger. They were also a case of leading to the destruction of language and culture. And thirdly is the attitudes of imperial powers, whether it's Britain and whether it's Russia or previously the Soviet Union, and the belittling of the Irish, the belittling of the Ukrainians. These are not people who are capable of running their independent state. They're just a bunch of peasants. They don't really have a real culture and language. We are bringing them civilization, whether it's from Britain or whether it's from Russia, and they should accept that we are the ones that should be in charge, as it were. So it's a kind of a denial of their right to be sovereign states, their denial of their right to develop their own languages and cultures. And so the similarities in both countries are very close. And that is why I wrote this comparison of Ireland and of Ukraine.
Taras, thank you very much for joining us on the programme. Dr. Taras Kuzio, Professor of Political Science at the National University of Kiev Mohyla Academy. Thank you, Taras.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.